She came and looked at Albertina, and then she spoke some low, submissive, but reproachful words to her master, and stroked Albertina's face with a piteous hand. I think she had meant to wash the tabletop with the water she was heating, for the table was now very dirty and her house was very clean. But instead she took the pan off the hook and invited me to clamber in and wash myself, while she herself made a soft pad of hay, moistened it, and gently wiped the blood and muck from Albertina. The centaur saucepan made me a snugly fitting hip bath, and when I had finished, she indicated I should sit in front of the fire and dry myself, while she put Albertina to bed on the straw. But I saw Albertina's eyelids flutter and went to her at once. Again the mare spoke to her husband and then to me with the intonation of a question. I thought she must be asking me if Albertina was my mate, so I repeated the sound she had made back to her in a strongly affirmative tone. She looked exceedingly surprised. And then she smiled most tenderly and let us both lie down together, while she covered us up with straw and the catechism droned softly on. The mayor must have talked to her husband during the night, because he came to our bed in the morning, abased himself, and kissed my feet, because she was my mate, therefore my property, and so he must apologize to me. Tears ran out of his eyes. He whipped himself for me. Then he went out to conduct morning service, and after that I ate my breakfast with the family, sitting on a stump of wood his wife found for me, while the males all sat on their haunches and ate with their hands from wooden dishes, like sylvan men, and the women waited until the men had finished before they took their own meal. But Albertina could not stir from her bed, and only feebly sipped a mouthful or two of the milk I tried to feed her. Their diet was one of rustic simplicity. The women ground their corn in stone querns and made flat tortilla-like pancakes, which they ate with the wild honey in which they also deliciously preserved fruit. They sometimes roasted the ears of corn on the hot coals. Morning and evening they milked the cactuses into wooden buckets, fermented the milk to make a sour but invigorating drink, and also made flat white cheeses with a sweet, bland flavor and a crumbling texture. They cultivated orchards of fruit and vegetable gardens of roots and tubers. They gathered salads in the forests and also mushrooms, which they particularly liked to eat raw, dressed with oil and vinegar. They made sweet syrup from berries, but the sacred horse had not revealed to them the mysteries of alcohol. So their religion was only a Spartan, teetotal variation upon Dionysianism, and their grapes went only into jellies and salad dressings. Their abstemious vegetarian diet filled them out with iron muscle. Their teeth were white and perfect. They died only of accident and old age took a long time to come to them. But their lives were only apparently tranquil. Every day of the week and every week of the year was irradiated by the continuous divine drama unfolding in the voices of the singers and the turning of the year. So they lived primarily on dramaturgical terms. This gave the women a certain dignity that would otherwise have been denied them, for every one of the most insignificant household tasks, mucking out, bringing water from the spring, picking the lice from one another's manes and tails, was performed as if in a divine theater. As if, for example, each mare was the embodiment of the archetypal bridal mare as she cleaned the celestial stable. Even if the bridal mare was only a penitent sinner, still, she was essential to the sacred horse's passion. Therefore, every minute of the day, they were all male and female alike, engrossed in weaving and embroidering the rich fabric of the very world in which they lived. And like so many Penelopes, their work was never finished. The whole point of their activity was that it was endless, for they unraveled their work at the end of the year and then, with the return of the sun after the shortest day, began on it again. The horse tree in the holy hill was the central node of their world, for it was the living skeleton of the sacred stallion, left them as an authoritarian reminder by the deity himself. Their conduct was regulated by the tree's responses to the seasons, and the sacred stallion died when the leaves fell. Yet for all its sanctity, the tree was really no more than a kind of anthropoid vegetable clock, for it only told them when it was proper to perform certain choric cantatas. For, as I say, their drama was comprehensive enough to be extremely flexible. And if the tree had been blasted one night by lightning, the Church of the Horse would have absorbed this event into a new mutation of the central myth after a period of spiritual reorientation. They were not fabulous beasts. They were entirely mythic. Sometimes I thought they were not really centaurs at all, but only men who possessed such a deep conviction the universe was a horse, that it was impossible for them to see any evidence that hinted things might be otherwise. Their language was far simpler than it seemed at first. It consisted primarily of sound clusters and intuition, and though it was quite different from any human language, it was easy enough for a man to grasp, and before 3 weeks passed, both Albertina and I had enough of the rudiments to make simple conversation with our hosts, and so learned something of the consternation into which our arrival had plunged them. We had disrupted the cycle, and they were still going through a painful period of readjustment. They had searched all through their holy books and found there no formulae of hospitality. We were the first visitors they had ever had in their entire legendary history. And when we learned to say their equivalent of good morning, their consternation reached a giddy height, for there was no sound in their language with which to define a sentient, communicable being who was not mostly horse. But since they had found us on the holy hill, they knew we were a sign from heaven, though they had not yet decided just what it was we signified. While they racked their brains over the problem, they took certain hygienic precautions. They would not let us go and watch their matins and their evensong, and they never left us entirely alone together, for fear we might propagate other as yet indigestible marvels before they could find a means of digesting us. Apart from that, they treated us kindly, and after I received permission from the bey to browse among his books, I soon filled my days by turning my old talents at the crossword puzzle to solving the riddle of their runes. Poor Albertina took a long time to recover from her ordeal. The roan mare and I looked after her and fed her warm milk mixed with honey and a rich porridge made from corn, kept her warm and attended to everything, but her fever did not leave her for 3 days, and she could hardly walk but only hobble for more than a fortnight. She was brave, and soon stopped flinching when she saw the bay. While the children shyly brought her wild strawberries arranged on platters of fresh leaves or bunches of the poppies and moon daisies that grew in the corn, because she was so holy. I sat beside Albertina with my books as the roan mare did the housework, and Albertina told me, in the way of those who are sick far from home, of her childhood in Hoffmann's Schloss, of her rarely seen father, who had seemed so formidable to the little Albertina, of the frail mother with bridled eyes who died so soon, and of certain pet rabbits, birds, and other playthings. She did not speak of the war or of her father's researches. She seemed content to rest for a while and gather her strength. She begged me to watch for the aerial patrols, and so I went up to the Holy Hill every morning and scanned the sky. Though I always saw only clouds and birds, she never gave up hope, but said, "Perhaps tomorrow." My trips to the hill only helped confirm our host's theory that we must be numinous. The more I was beside her, the more I loved her. At last I began to gain some glimmerings of the centaur's cosmogony. The books of the sacred stallion were painted with brushes they used in the tattooing operation, on a kind of parchment made from the barks of certain trees characterized by a leaf formation like a horse's tail, for they believed in an elaborate system of correspondence. Their cuneiform script was based on the marks of their own hooves and, though all men could read, only the scrivener was allowed to practice the art of writing it. It was hermetic knowledge and handed down only from eldest son to eldest son. When the scrivener's wife bore him no sons, they considered the sequential inheritance so important, he was permitted to put his old wife away and take a new one, the only circumstances in which they allowed divorce. But the script was simplicity itself. It was a system of marks corresponding in size exactly to sounds, and, after a few lessons from the astonished bay, I was soon able to figure it out well enough. They called themselves the distorted seed of the dark archer, although this name was so terrible it could not be spoken aloud, only whispered from one cantor to his successor during the course of his 3-week-long initiation. It was an awareness of imminent damnation that kept them at their devotions with such fervor and the mark of Cain they printed upon their backs. It was clearly a matter of pride with them to grow as glorious in their mutilations as they possibly could. And all this was the brooding counterpoint, unspoken yet known, that lent such passion to their worship. I sheared the thick flesh of rhetoric from the contents, ignored the stories of lesser heroes, and was left with this skeleton. The bridal mare marries the sacred stallion, who instantly impregnates her, but, while in foal, she deceives him with a former suitor, the dark archer. Spurred by jealousy, the dark archer shoots the sacred stallion in the eye with an arrow. As he dies, the sacred stallion tells the dark archer his children will be born in degenerate forms. The dark archer and the bridal mare cook and eat the sacred stallion to hide their crime. But a desolation immediately comes upon the country, and, repentant, they weep themselves ferociously for 39 days. This corresponded to a fast at midwinter and must have been truly astonishing to watch, but we did not stay among them long enough to have the chance of seeing it. On the 40th day, the mare, in a uroboric parturition, gives birth, with extraordinary suffering, to none other than the sacred stallion himself, who ascends into the celestial stable in the shape of his own foal. The remainder of the liturgical year was taken up with lengthy and overbearing forgiveness and his many teachings of the art of singing, of the techniques of the smithy, of corn growing, of cactus culture, of cheese making and of writing, and all the almost countless ways in which they must conduct their lives in order to atone for their sins. And then matured, the sacred stallion descends from the sky and once again marries the bridal mare. So that was why they held women in such low esteem. and why they would not touch meat, and why they hung a broken bow on the horse tree. And now I understood they were not so much weaving a fabric of ritual with which to cover themselves, but using the tools of ritual to shore up the very walls of the world. Albertina was as concerned as I with the texture of the life of our hosts, but not from any simple childish curiosity such as mine. She had become engrossed in the problem of the reality status of the centaurs, and the more she talked of it, the more I admired her ruthless empiricism. For she was convinced that even though every male in the village had obtained carnal knowledge of her, the beast was still only emanations of her own desires, dredged up and objectively reified from the dark abysses of the unconscious. And she told me that, according to her father's theory, all the subjects and objects we had encountered in the loose grammar of nebulous time were derived from a similar source, my desires, or hers, or the Count's. At first, especially the Count's, for he had lived on closer terms with his own unconscious than we. But now our desires, perhaps, had achieved their day of independence. I remember the words of another German savant and quoted to her. In the unconscious, nothing can be created or destroyed. Footnote, Sigmund Freud, The Interpretation of Dreams, Desiderio. Yet we saw the Count destroyed, and I myself destroyed the cannibal chief. Destruction is only another aspect of being, she said categorically, and with that I had to be content. Yet we ate the bread of the centaurs and were nourished by it. So I saw that, if what she believed was so, these phantoms were not in the least insignificant, for the existence of the methodical actuality on whose beds of straw we slept, whose language we were forced to learn, this complex reality with its fires, its cheeses, its complicated theology, and its magnificent handwriting, this concrete, authentic, self-consistent world was begotten from phenomenal dynamics alone, the product of a random becoming, the first of the wonderful flowers that would bloom in the earth her father had prepared for them, by means she, as yet, refused to so much as hint at, except to say they had to do with desire and radiant energy and the persistence of vision. We were living then according to the self-determined laws of a group of synthetically authentic phenomena. Because they did not have a word for guest or even visitor, they began to treat us at last with a nervous compassion. But until they expanded the liturgy to absorb us, we were at best irritating irrelevancies, distracting them from the majestic pageant of their ritual lives. We did not even have anything to teach them. They knew all they needed to know, and when I tried to tell the Bey that by far the greater number of social institutions in the world were made by weak, two-legged, thin-skinned creatures, much the same as Albertina and I, he told me in so many words that I was lying. For because they were men, they had many words to describe conditions of deceit. They were not Houyhnhnms. When we could speak the language fluently and Albertina had quite recovered, they put her to work in the fields with the women because it was harvest time. The women reaped the corn and brought it to the village in sheaves on their backs. When all was gathered in, they would thresh it during the performance of semi-secular harvest songs on a communal threshing floor. Soon Albertina became as brown as an Indian, for the yellowish pigment of her Mongolian skin took to sunshine in as friendly a fashion as my own did. She would come home in the golden evenings, wreathed with corn like a pagan deity in a pastoral, naked as a stone, for they did not give us back our clothes, and we never needed to cover ourselves for the weather was always warm. But even when all her wounds were healed, she would not let me touch her, though she would not tell me why, except to say that the time was not yet ripe. So we lived like loving brother and sister, even if I was always a little in awe of her. For sometimes her eyes held a dark, blasting lightning, and her face fell into the carven lines of the statue of a philosopher. At these times, a sense of her difference almost withered me, for she was the sole heir to her father's kingdom, and that kingdom was the world. And I had nothing. Familiarity did not diminish her strangeness nor her magnetism. Every day I found her all the more miraculous, and I would gaze at her for hours together, as though I were feeding on her eyes. And, as I remember, she, too, would gaze at me. But we were prisoners of the centaurs, and did not know if we would ever be free, unless her father's area patrols sighted us. Because I was male, they did not let me do any work, and seemed happy enough to let me wander around the village, learning what I could learn. Perhaps they even thought, when they saw me poring over their books, they might even be able to enlist me in their ceremonies one day, as an ink-bearer or an assistant fustigator. I do not know. But I do know they were making their plans for us. When the cantor, the tattoo master, the smith, and the scrivener talked together, they always talked in whispers. But now they met together more and more frequently. They were always at their whisperings, and the scrivener, with a choir around him chanting, would sit at the table in his stable and write in a new big book in the evenings. When I went to watch the tattooing, I found the art was as remarkable as the method was atrocious. First, they chose a design from the pictures in the ancient volumes of blueprints and drew it on the skin with the brush. But then the pain began, for the artist did not use a relatively humane needle. He kept in a consecrated chest his artillery of triangular-shaped awls and gouges. He ground and mixed his pigments himself. He and his sons, his apprentices, went into the forest to search for the ingredients, for their mixes and colors. Taken from the minerals in the earth and dried powdered plants, were often toxic enough to produce an effect as of scalding, and always a terrible itching, although the skin of the man-parts was far tougher than human skin. So one often saw young boys feverishly scratching their half-embroidered backs against rough trunks of trees in the mornings, after their visits to the master. Learning a tattooing, the tattoo master's stable was halfway between an operating theater and the chapel. His wife scrubbed down the table and set out a pillow of straw on which the boy victim rested his head as he lay face down, while the master's three sons lined up chanting, one carrying the awls and gouges, another the paint, and a third a bowl of water and a sponge. The cantor at the head of the table began to sing. He sang the sympathetic magic of the emblem, how he who wore the horse indented on his skin took on the virtue of horses, while the master plunged the brush in the ink with his left hand and, taking in the other an awl or gouge, depending on the thickness of the desired line, he rubbed the instrument in the wet brush and pushed the coloring matter under the skin. And then the third son wiped the blood away with a sponge. Each of the children's visits lasted an hour. The tattoo master always had a full day's work. The more complicated designs, those for the children of the church dignitaries, could take up to a year to complete. And the women especially suffered terribly in the regions around their nipples. And all the time they suffered, the song went on. Religion was their only analgesic. Work on the tattoo of the bay's son was almost complete. Only another few hours' work, and he would become a work of religious art as preposterous as it was magnificent. But we never saw him in his final ridiculous splendor, for one day at breakfast, the bay said to me, "She is not to go to the fields today. I shall come for both of you after prayers, and you will go to the holy hill with me." He smiled grimly, and with even a certain affection, or rather, with a tolerant acquiescence in my presence at his breakfast table, when I could not even sit down decently on all fours. And at Albertina's presence, as she waited quietly with his mate and daughter for their own share of the meal. We did not have the least idea what would happen to us on the holy hill, for we were in nebulous time. All we could do was help the roan mare clean the wooden platters and wait for his return. I knew from my studies of their books no special ritual was scheduled for today. We were in the time of transmission of divine knowledge number 2, and that was concerned with the art of the smith. Yet foolishly, I felt no suspicion. When they saw how badly the rape had injured Albertina, they had realized we were both more delicately put together than they, and treated us physically with the greatest respect. Yet I do not think they even understood quite how feeble we were. It was impossible for them to do so. And like all grown-ups, they were quite sure they always knew what was best. Yet I felt the first misgivings when I saw a solemn procession line up before the bay stable, and the cantor lead them all in a song I had never heard before. It was plainly an unusual day, for none of the women had gone to the fields. Even the tattoo master had left his table to take a prominent place in the procession, with his sons ranked behind him, and the soot-stained smith, the black, had abandoned his forge, while the dapple grey scrivener stood at the head of them all, and his son ceremoniously carried the suspiciously new book on which he had been working. Perhaps it was a holiday, for all the women were carrying picnic baskets. But they did not have a word for holiday. And then the bay took Albertine and me, one by each hand, and so we went out of the village, and all the time he sang a new song called "Consecration of a Newly Discovered Book of the Scriptures." A light mist lay over the fields that morning, so we could see no further than the golden tassels of ripe corn that brushed us as we passed, and hear nothing besides the bay's mahogany-colored baritone but the soft, regimented clop of their hoofbeats on the rutted path. Because it was nebulous time, one could have imagined it the dawn of time, the anteriority of all times, since nebulous time was the womb of time. For the first time, led like a child by the great bay, whose form was so much nobler than mine, and whose sense of the coherence of his universe was so inflexible, my own conviction that I was a man named Desiderio, born in a certain city, the child of a certain mother, lover of a certain woman, began to waver. If I was a man, what was a man? The bay offered me a logical definition: a horse in a state of ultimate, biped, maneless, tailless decadence. I was a naked, stunted, deformed dwarf who one day might begin to forget what purpose such a thing as a name of my own served. And the brown thing with breasts who held the bay's other hand was my mate. From the waist upwards, she was passable, if ugly, because not equine, but from the waist down, vile. And besides, she was incomplete because there were none of the necessary scars on her skin. How naked we were. I began to think of the centaurs as our masters, you see. Although Albertina had warned me, the pressures of nebulous time alone forced them to live with such certitude. And perhaps I was indeed looking for a master. Perhaps the whole history of my adventure could be titled Desiderio in Search of a Master. But I only wanted to find a master, the minister, the count, the bey, so I could lean on him at first and then, after a while, jeer. If Albertina had known how despicable I was, she would not have given me a second thought. When we came to the holy hill, they all neighed hallelujah and evacuated. Then they spread down straw they had brought with them under the tree so that we should not have to lie down in horse dung when they laid us down. The scrivener nailed the new book to the tree. The prayers were interminable. The tattoo master and the cantor performed an endless cantata for tenor and baritone, while the three boys who bore the instruments of torture waited with the blind indifference of trees. As I listened to the singing, I learned from the text how the master I longed for proposed to treat us. We would be tattooed upon the holy hill where the sacred stallion had first set us down. He had sent us into the world to show his flock what fearful shapes they might all still come to if they did not adhere even more strictly than before to his dogmas. But in his infinite compassion, the stallion had decided to integrate us with the celestial herd. They would paint us with his picture, and then, to make us resemble him even more, they would nail the iron shoes on our feet with red-hot nails. After that, they would take us into the forest and give us to the spirits. That is, the wild horses who would certainly trample us to death. Red Hot Nail in person threw back his mane and neighed. We heard every word. I turned my head a little and saw she was crying. I stretched up my hand towards her and grasped it. Whatever the reality status of the centaurs, they certainly had the power to deprive us forever of any reality at all, for it was certain we would die together. If not from the first sacrament, then from the second, and if we managed to survive that, the third would certainly end us. I felt a certain clarity and composure, for matters were quite out of our control. If we were the victims of unleashed, unknown desires, then die we must. For as long as those desires existed, we would finish by killing one another. Yes, I thought so, even then. The tattoo master knelt and took the brush. She shivered when she felt the chill, wet tongue of horsehair lick along her spine, and I held her hand more tightly. The congregation drummed their hooves. The cantor chanted and mimed, I think, the dance of the horsehair writing brush. I do not know how long it took before her back was painted over completely. I do not know how long it took to paint me. But when we were both finished, they stopped the ceremony to eat their lunches and brought us some milk and cold pancakes, too, though they would not let us get up because the paint was not yet dry. When the brief meal was over, our ordeal would begin in earnest. She trembled, and I remembered how she looked when she was Lafleur. And yet I knew she was far braver than I. It was late morning, and the sun was shining very brightly. The morning mist had dried, and the sky was amazingly clear and blue. She raised herself up on her elbows as high as she could, and, shading her eyes with her hands, she gazed into the far distance. Again I remembered Lafleur looking for a storm, although I knew she was searching for her father's aerial patrols. However, I did not believe in the patrols. Yet, as she trembled, I saw it was not with fear, but with hope, or perhaps a kind of effortful strain. She gripped my hand more tightly, until her nails dug into my palm. I remembered the scrap of paper in the pocket of the peep-show proprietor's nephew. My desires concentrated to a single point. I am sure what happened next was coincidence. I am positive of that. I would stake my life on it. "Look," she hissed on a triumphantly expelled breath. In the far distance, the sunlight glinted on the wings of a metal bird. But that was not the most remarkable thing. That was not the extraordinary coincidence. The litany began again, and the cantor threw almost on top of us an ecstasy so wonderful I could not see anything but his flailing hooves and sweat-drenched loins whirling above me. His consummation laid him low. He sprawled on the ground, kicking his hooves spasmodically. And in the tremendous silence, I heard the whirring of an engine. But either they were too transfigured to hear it, or they thought it was the sound of a clattering insect in the corn. And yes, the sap in the horse tree went on busily buzzing. And then came the sacerdotal moment. The awl raised the brush and the piercing instrument. And this was the coincidence. At the very moment he bent down to make the first incision, the buzzing horse tree went up in flames. "Ignite all in their way!" The scrivener might have written a new book, but it did not allow for so much improvisation. Besides, now the book was burning. The dried dung at the roots of the tree caught almost instantaneously, and a lasso of flame captured the bay's tail. He thrashed his sparkling torch this way and that way, howling, and he dropped dung not in prayer, but this time in fear. The tattoo master turned into a horse of ivory and flame, and suddenly they were all on fire. All the priests around us, and our bed of straw was blazing too. But Albertina and I ran out and through the wall of fire, to run as fast as we could through the waning havoc, to the helicopter that had landed in the cornfield. Chapter 8. The Castle. While the co-pilot filmed the scene below with a television camera, the helicopter rose in a rattle of whirling metal. When I looked down, I saw the wide valley of the Centaurs open out like a French 18th-century neoclassical fan painted by a follower of Poussin, and then close up again as we flew so low above the forest itself, the topmost branches scraped against the cabin walls. So all those months of ourselves vanished without a trace, and I heard the pilot call Albertina, Madame, and then Generalissimo Hoffman. When I turned from the window, I saw she had already put on one of their spare combat suits of drab olive twill, and was now combing out her black hair, which had grown halfway down her back during our captivity. The co-pilot put away his camera and dug into a locker to produce clothes for me, too. Now she was dressed, I was embarrassed at my nakedness, and hurried to cover myself, though my fingers fumbled over the unfamiliar buttons. "Am I the General's Batman?" I asked her, but she only smiled at me remotely and began to pore over a map the co-pilot handed her. He and the pilot were both swarthy, silent young men in black berets who chewed on long black cigars. They spoke mainly a laconic French, and I felt I had seen men like them very often before, but only in newsreel films. I was given coffee from a thermos flask, and they cleared me a place in the cramped quarters, so that I could sit down. I had not been in the 20th century for so long that I felt quite stunned. A radio began to squawk messages in the standard speech of my country. I had not heard my own language for a long time. When we were among the Centaurs, Albertina and I had used it as a private language, such a secretive children event for themselves, and I was shocked to recall the speech was common property. The coffee was hot and strong. They opened a wax paper parcel of ham sandwiches. Albertina absently plaited her hair, and as she did so, she put away all her romanticism. Her face was hard and brown and impersonal. I sipped my coffee. She spoke into the radio transmitter, but I could make out nothing whatsoever of what she said because of the noise the engines made. And then Albertina had finished. She gave the pilot back the microphone, sighed, smiled, and came to crouch beside me. "Not my Batman," she said. "The doctor will commission you. He just told me that." "Even though I'm enlisted on the other side?" "You will go wherever I go," she said with such conviction. I was silent, for I had just seen her passion set fire to a tree, and now I was in the real world again. I was not quite sure I wanted to burn with her, or at least not yet. I felt an inexplicable indifference towards her. Perhaps because she was now yet another she, and this she was the absolute antithesis of my black swan and my bouquet of burning bone. She was a crisp, antiseptic soldier to whom other ranks deferred. I began to feel perfidious, for I had no respect for rank. "And what of my city?" I asked her, drawing on a cigar the pilot gave me. She frowned into her plastic tumbler of coffee. "The course of the war was dramatically altered by the destruction of the set of samples. Why, my father was modifying the transmitters. The minister completed his computer bank and then instituted a program he called the Rectification of Names. In spite of himself, he was forced to use philosophic weapons, or, as he would probably prefer to call them, ideological weapons. He decided he could only keep a strict control of his actualities by adjusting their names to agree with them perfectly. So you understand that no shadow would fall between the word and the thing described. For the minister hypothesized, my father worked in that shadowy land between the thinkable and the thing thought of. And if he destroyed this difference, he would destroy my father. Do you follow me?"
"More or less."
"He set up a new slogan. If the name is right, you will see the light. He is a man of great intellect but limited imagination, which is why he can hold out against my father, of course. Once the names were right, he thought perfect order and hence perfect government, on his own Confucian terms, would follow automatically. So he dismissed all his physicists and brought in a team of logical positivists from the School of Philosophy in the National University, and set them to the task of fixing all the phenomena compiled by his computers in the solid concrete of a set of names that absolutely agreed with them. Ironically enough, their task was made all the easier because of the flexibility of identity produced in the state of nebulous time." She paused. A yellowish glare flooded the cabin. "Look! We are crossing the desert, the mother of mirages," she said. There was no more forest, only sand drifting in dry spirals, the very color of sterility, and above us, a sky as lifeless as the earth. "This is your minister's place," she said. "He has not got enough imagination to realize that the most monstrous aberrations are bound to flourish in soil once it has been disinfected of the imagination." And though I loved her more than anything in the world, I remembered the music of Mozart and murmured to the Queen of the Night, "I do not think so." But she did not hear me because of the noise of the engines and the turning propellers. So when the transmitters were operating again, the images we sent out bounced off the intellectual walls the minister had built. My poor father, he was almost disconcerted, because I was lost in nebulous time just when he needed me most. The helicopter followed its own shadow over the realm of spiritual death. But now I have been in contact with him at last, and he is only waiting for our return to start the second front. For our return, for you and for me as well. "Yes," she said, and turned her ensorcelating eyes on me, so that all at once I was breathless with desire and the cabin dissolved in our kiss. Yet there was still that duplicity in my heart's core. I had been marked out at the beginning as the minister's man for all my apathy, for all my disaffection. For I, too, would have worshipped reason if I could ever have found her shrine. Reason was stamped into me as if it were a chromosome, even if I loved the high priestess of passion. Nevertheless, we kissed, and the crew of the helicopter shielded their eyes as though we were too bright for them to bear. Then the pilot sighted a walled fort with a landing strip beside it, on which stood two spare, lean military transports. We landed in a helicopter port inside the fort itself, which I believe I had once seen in a film of the Foreign Legion. A complement of troopers manned it. They were as brown and down-to-earth as the crew of the helicopter, and they too all called Albertina Generalissimo. We were given a bath, and I got myself a military haircut, for my hair had grown almost as long as Albertina's. Then we had an austere dinner of army rations, for although she was a general, she was not given preferential treatment, and lay down on two hard iron beds with flat pillows and coarse gray blankets in a barracks that smelled of disinfectant, where I could not have made love to her even if she had let me, because 20 other men were sleeping there. I'd forgotten how convenient the real world was. How, for example, hot water came boiling out of taps marked hot. How good it felt to sleep between sheets. And, though there were no clocks in the fort, all the soldiers had come to an informal agreement on a common standard of time. So our breakfast, full of nostalgic flavors of bacon, toast, tea, and marmalade, was served at the hour we had all agreed to wake up. Then, when everything was ready, the commandant of the fort kissed Albertina on both cheeks. We climbed into a military transport and flew far more simply, though much more lengthily, than in any dream, directly to Hoffmann's castle. And nothing whatever happened to ripple the serene, accommodating surface of events, except the constant presence of Albertina's eyes. Ocean and jungle, and finally, remembered peaks jutting against the sky of evening. I waited expectantly for a sense of homecoming, but I experienced nothing. With a faint sinking of the heart, as the plane dipped and circled, I thought that perhaps now I was a stranger everywhere. It was a hazardous descent into the mountains, for Hoffman's own landing strip was well concealed from the air. and I saw nothing of the castle itself as we came down, only the reeling peaks. A jeep was waiting for us. It took us along a rough track through long, black shadows of approaching night. But I saw among the rocks before me, four moons were already shining high in the secret crests. They were four huge, concave saucers of very highly polished metal that circled like windmills, and were all turned towards the city I knew lay below me to the south. Plainly, they were part of the transmission system, even though they were so blatantly technological. I was so busy watching them I did not see the castle, though it lay before us, until the jeep stopped and Albertina, with a rush of joy in her voice, said, "We are nearly home." Almost, but not entirely, for we still had to cross a chasm in the earth by a wooden bridge so fragile we must walk, and so narrow we could only go one at a time. The driver of the jeep spoke a strange mixture of French and Spanish, and wore a battered anti-uniform of green twill. He kissed Albertina on both cheeks and rode away, leaving us alone. We went out onto the bridge. The chasm was some 60 feet wide, and below its lips, sheer precipices fell to a depth of 1,000 feet or more, so deep you could not see what lay at the bottom. Beyond the bridge was a little green grove about 4 acres in area, surrounded on all sides by the crags in which the transmitters were lodged. It was a sweet female kernel nestling in the core of the virile, thrusting rock. The trees in the grove were full of fruit, and the dappled and variegated chalices of enormous flowers seemed to be breathing out all the perfume they had stored up during the day, in these last moments before they closed for the night. Brilliant birds sang on the branches in which chattering squirrels swung, and the luxuriant grass rustled with rabbits, while beautiful roe deer sauntered among the trees, holding up their heads proudly like princes, under the weights of their antlered crowns. It did not look as though winter had ever touched it, and as we drew nearer, our footsteps ringing with a hollow sound on the wooden bridge, I remembered I had seen a picture of Hoffman's Park, a magically transformed picture in which all the detail had been heightened, but still recognizably a dream vision of this very park. I had seen it in the peep show. It was the park framed by the female orifice in the first machine of all. And when I looked beyond the trees, I saw the very same castle I had seen then. The castle stood with its back up against a cliff. The battlements hinted at Hoffmann's Teutonic heritage. He had built himself a Wagnerian castle like a romantic memory in stone. And as the light faded, the castle began to open eyes of many beautiful colors, for all the windows were of stained glass. And yet I knew I was not dreaming. My feet left prints on the grass, and Albertina picked me an apple from a tree, and I brushed away the bloom and bit into it, and my teeth went crunch. While the transmitters flashed, a roaring in the sky told us the transport had taken off again. Or another transport had taken off, for there was a hangar full of the things at the military base at the airstrip. "What a year it's been for apples," said Albertina. "Look how heavy the crop is. The trees are bending almost to the ground." When I went away to Quarantine's account, it was apple blossom time. "You can't imagine how beautiful the apple blossom is, Desiderio." I finished my apple and threw away the core. So the princess was taking it for granted I was interested in her patrimonial apple blossom, was she? What presumption. Perhaps she should not have told me so plainly in her ownership tone of voice, that all this was hers, the castle, the orchards, the mountains, the earth, the sky, all that lay between them. I don't know. All I know is I could not transcend myself sufficiently to inherit the universe. Although it was real, I knew the perfection around me was impossible. And perhaps I was right. But now I am too old to know or care. I can no longer tell the difference between memory and dream. They share the same quality of wishful thinking. I thought at the time perhaps I was a terrorist in the cause of reason, though I probably tried to justify myself with such a notion later. But when I close my eyes, I see her still, walking through the orchard towards her father's house, in her soldier's uniform, her heavy black plaits hanging down her back like a little girl's. Nobody came to meet us, but the front door was open. A door at the top of a not in the least grandiloquent but cracked and mossy staircase. For it was not really a castle, only a country house built after the style of a castle. We entered first a somber, low-ceilinged hall scented with potpourri and furnished with carved chairs, Chinese pots, and oriental rugs. I do not know what I had been expecting, but certainly never this tranquility, this domestic peace, for were we not in the house of the magician himself? However, the transmitters sent out their beams high over its battlements and did not affect the fortress of the enemy itself. Here, everything was safe, everything was ordered, everything was secure. All that puzzled me were certain pictures on the wall. These pictures were heavily varnished oils executed in the size and style of the 19th century academician, and they all depicted faces and scenes I recognized from old photographs and from the sepia and olive reproductions of forgotten masterpieces in the old-fashioned books the nuns gave us to look at when I was a child in the evenings after supper, when we had been good. When I read the titles engraved on metal plaques at the bottom of each frame, I saw they depicted such scenes as Leon Trotsky composing the Eroica Symphony, the wire-rimmed spectacles, the Hebraic bush of hair, the burning eyes were all familiar. The light of inspiration was in his eyes, and the crotches and quavers rippled from his nib onto the sheets of manuscript paper, which flew about the red plush cover of the mahogany table on which he worked, as if blown by the fine frenzy of genius. Van Gogh was shown writing Wuthering Heights in the parlor of Haworth Parsonage, with bandaged ear, all complete. I was especially struck by the gigantic canvas of Milton blindly executing divine frescoes upon the walls of the Sistine Chapel. Seeing my bewilderment, Albertina said, smiling, "When my father rewrites the history books, these are some of the things that everyone will suddenly perceive to have always been true." Though the signs of the scrupulous attentions of servants were apparently everywhere, the house seemed quite deserted. We were welcomed only by an ancient lumbering dog who heaved himself painfully up from a rug in front of a little log fire, burning more for the sake of the scent of apple wood and the sight of flame than the need for warmth, who came and thrust his wet nose in Albertina's palm, whining for joy. "When I was little, he used to give me rides on his back," she said. "How wide his muzzle is growing." Wheezing and panting, the Great Dane followed us up a staircase and along a gallery, but we left him outside a room in which a stained glass window dyed the valley outside purple and crimson, and Ravel was playing on a very elaborate hi-fi set. A diminutive, dark-haired woman in a long, black dress lay on a couch with her face turned away from us. There, holding her hand, sat the doctor himself on a low, padded stool. I knew him at once, though he was far older than the pictures I had seen, of course. Even if he still wedged open one eye with a monocle, just as his old professor had told me he did. There was a strong smell of incense in the room, which did not quite conceal the smell of incipient putrefaction. When he let go of the woman's hand, it fell with a lifeless thud. The one discordant note in all this rich man's sumptuous